All right. So, I told you at the close of class last week what the title of the lesson was going to be, and I messed it up. So, we are going to look at the Behemoth and Leviathan before the night's over. But let's kind of recap a little bit. Job 40, verses 1 through 5, then the Lord said to Job, "Will the fault finder contend with the Almighty? Let him who reproves God answer it. Can anyone understand the mind of God?" And last week we read God's taking Job to school moment in Job 38, where God posed multiple rhetorical questions to Job to point out the human position in the eyes of God, not just Job's, but all of ours. Utter insignificance in size, in truth, in originality, and in power. And then you name some others if you have some. But one example of these great points presented by Jehovah is in verse 30. Job 38, verses 29 through 30, we read, "For from whose womb has the ice come, and the frost of heaven? Who has given it birth? Water becomes hard like stone, and the surface of the deep is imprisoned." If you have been in my classes before, you may remember that I referred to James Kaufman commentaries on occasion. I'm not planning to change that. But on this freezing of the water, Brother Kaufman wrote this: "Do not men know all about things such as these? The answer is no. And one of the greatest mysteries of the whole physical creation is mentioned in Job 38 and verse 30. Let it be noted that due to freezing, the water has become like stone. Why then should it have been the face of the deep, the surface of ponds and rivers, that should be congealed or frozen? That amazing phenomenon that water expands when it freezes, contrary to practically every other liquid known to men, is inexplicable. No scientist ever born failed to marvel at it," he says. "The answer lies with God alone." The depth of God's word is so timeless. I knew water expands. I knew that you have to leave some space in a water bottle for that expansion. However, is this true? I mean, you probably are smarter than me in this. Some of you surely know, is this true that only water is, or basically only water is the only liquid that will expand when it freezes? So interesting. And so that's something that God said way back then. And so Job gets taken to school. By chapter 40, Job gets the message for sure. Verse 3, "Then Job answered the Lord and said, Behold, I am insignificant." New American Standard Version. King James Version renders that vile. Have to say it that way too. Vile. And then the American Standard Version of 1901, which is very, very well respected, it says that Job said he is of small account. Love that. And then he finished with this: "What can I reply to thee? I lay my hands on my mouth," and we might say zip it up, zip up the lips. So however, in chapter 38, Job received more than his belly aching bargained for. God unleashed on him a great buildup of why Job had no right to question the Creator. And to be quite frank and earnest, does anyone earn the right to question God? Answer: only one, Jesus Christ. And he did that on the cross, didn't he? My God, why have you forsaken me?" What a harsh question. Do I have the right to say those words? God, why have you forsaken me? Well, God allows those kinds of questions. Just look how long he let Job go on complaining. But a better question might be, would I be justified in asking God accusatory questions like Jesus did? Now, taking a step back, I don't believe Jesus was accusing his father of anything sinister. I'm confident Jesus was asking a factual question. Now, I don't understand the question. I don't understand the depth of the question. But that being said, that's a whole nother study all of its own. In a great article on apologeticspress.org, Dr. Dave Miller expounded on this lecture that God gave Job. And I'd like to share a few excerpts from it. And incidentally, this is also a quote from his book, which I purchased, and I highly recommend it, Behemoth and Leviathan. And in the midst of his extreme suffering, Job needed an attitude adjustment. He said some things that cast God in a questionable light. So he needed to have his knowledge challenged and be reminded of his finite humanity. He needed to be reminded to whom the universe belongs. He needed to be humbled to the extent that he no longer required an explanation or expected God to give an account of himself. After all, God is God, and we are mere humans who deserve nothing from him except an eternal hell which we have earned by our own behavior, Romans 6 and 23. Indeed, so far is he above our ability to grasp much of reality that we could not understand most of his explanations anyway. Well said. And he references Isaiah chapter 55, verses 8 through 9. For my thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are your ways my ways, declares the Lord. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts. Dr. Miller continues with a great explanation of the book of Job, and I like this summary of it. The central point of the book of Job concerns the fact that no matter what we face in this life, put emphasis on those words, no matter what we face in this life, no matter how intense or our suffering and hardship may become, when we genuinely shift our attention to who God is, we are enabled to cope with our suffering and successfully negotiate and survive the onslaughts of life. And you're saying, yes, I get that. Well, maybe you don't. Maybe you're not agreeing with that, but I think it's spot on. But then you might be asking, what's that got to do with animals of the Bible? Good question. Ask God. No, really, ask him. Because he brought up to Job some of the spectacular animals he created to make his point. What point? That we don't have any right to complain about anything, really. God, and we especially don't have any right to blame God. And I think about the silent sufferers that maybe even are worshipers at this congregation who really never complain, but you know they're going through it. Dr. Miller outlined the book of Job like this, chapters 1 and 2, Job's disasters. What a list. Chapters 3 to 31, notice how many chapters that is, Job's dialogues with his three friends. Maybe you can caption that, hot air, lots of hot air. Chapters 38 to 41, a lot shorter speeches, but those were God's speeches. And then chapter 42, Job's deliverance. How interesting the way that God patiently waited to avenge himself and straighten Job out. But that's just what he did. Can anyone say grace? And that's, I believe, is a good outline for that subject. He began with inanimate objects and earthly things and even the constellations. And then God began to build his case to a crescendo with smaller animals in the latter part of chapter 38. For instance, chapter 38, verses 39 to 41. "Canst thou hunt the prey for the lioness?" This is the American Standard Version. "Or satisfy the appetite of the young lions when they crouch in their dens and abide in the covert or the secret to lie in wait? Who provideth for the raven his prey when his young ones cry unto God and wander for lack of food?" After class last week, a great point was brought up by Sam Wallace. I appreciate that. About the different classifications of animals, especially thinking about the food chain. And I hadn't thought about that. Some animals are only going to eat plants. A cow won't be caught dead eating a steak, you see. And then other animals are all about meat. A salad is not on their menu. You might even have adopt that philosophy yourself. So the food chain is God's design, and God alludes to this here in verse 41 when he says, "Who provides the raven his prey," or his food, essentially. Before we move on to chapter 39, notice God is speaking of real animals. We don't have to be thinking about symbolism or any kind of metaphors. He's speaking of real animals with known characteristics. He's not telling Job about any creature he's unaware of. In fact, everyone then and now knows these characteristics about the animals God mentioned. There's an important point before we look at the larger animals later in God's speech. And I'm going to throw out a reference that is going to make some of you smile and some of you scratch your head. Mutual of Omaha's Wild Kingdom pointed out many of these things, just like the animal characteristics, back in my youth. And I remember it, you know, watching it every time it was on. And in chapter 39, God uses several animal examples to show Job he isn't all that. And neither are we. But remember, this is the same dude that God spoke to Satan about. Job verses 1 through 8. "And the Lord said to Satan, Have you considered my servant Job? For there is no one like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man, fearing God and turning away from evil." Blameless. Blameless was translated as perfect or undefiled, upright. By that word, it sounds like Job had it all put together. And in fact, this fascinated me. I found out that the origin of the word means coupled together. Coupled together. And yet, he needed an attitude adjustment. Chapter 39, God mentions wild goats, deer, wild donkey, a hawk, an eagle, an ostrich. And about these animals, there were traits that God expressed about them and questioned Job if he knew, knowing all along he didn't know. And I think it's fascinating. For instance, in Job 39 and verses 1 and 2, "Do you know the time the mountain goats give birth? Do you observe the calving of the deer? Can you count the mouths they fulfill? Can you count the months they fulfill? Or do you know the time they give birth?" How about us? Do we know those things? No, because they're wild animals. They're out in the wild. We're not watching them like God can see them. And so that's the point, isn't it? They are not watched as closely as a farm animal, for instance. And the point is, but God knows. God knows. God took his time explaining to Job how little he knew in order to get him to the crescendo. One of those steps was Behemoth. According to Strong's Concordance, the audio pronunciation was Behemoth. Is that a stress on the last syllable? Can you find... And maybe in your Bibles, you might have footnotes in your Bible that says that this was a hippopotamus. Interesting. Or a water ox. The origin word appears to be beast, which could be the same word for cattle. And so it's not very conclusive just for pure definition. Do you know what a behemoth is? Does anybody know? Can you shake your head this way? Consider for a moment God's description of behemoth. Job 40, verses 15 through 24. Behold, or look now, behemoth, which I made as well as you. He eats grass like an ox. Behold, why did he say it again? Look, as if, pay close attention. His strength is in his loins and his power in the muscles of his belly. He bends his tail like a cedar. The sinews of his thighs are knit together. So I throw in this, don't get in the way of that tail. Interesting to me. His bones are tubes of bronze. His limbs are like bars of iron. He is the first of the ways of God. Let his maker bring near his sword. Surely the mountains bring him food, and all the beasts of the field play there. Under the lotus plants he lies down, in the covert, or the secret, of the reeds and the marsh. The lotus plants cover him with shade. The willows of the brook surround him. Get this, if a river rages, he is not alarmed. He is confident, though the Jordan rushes into or rushes to his mouth. Can anyone capture him when he is on watch? With barbs, can anyone pierce his nose? So think about some of those things. He eats grass, so not like a lion. You know, they're going to avoid grass, but behemoth does. His strength is in his loins, and that comes from a root word meaning to be slender, actually. And meaning slender around the waist or the small of the back. So take note of the origin word that God used to refer to the description of this beast as slender or narrow, not wide like a hippo. Just an observation. There's power in his stomach muscles. He bends his tail like the cedar. And can't you imagine how much strength you must have in your hips or in your stomach, in your abdomen, to be able to swing a tail that's the size of a cedar tree? How big are we talking? We have heard and read of the cedars of Lebanon. They used those massive trees, and how massive are we saying, in order to build many things throughout the Old Testament. One source that I found said that that tree would grow to around 85 feet tall, and its circumference is 40 feet around. Now, I don't know about your wingspan, how much you can reach, but how many of us would it take to reach around a 40-foot tree? And if you do a little math, that comes out to around nearly 13 feet in diameter. That's from here to us, isn't it? How big of a tail does behemoth have then, if that's the description that God gave? How much strength in the hips does an animal need to swing around a tail like a cedar tree? Well, he goes on, bones like tubes of bronze, limbs like bars of iron. The Jordan River floods. He doesn't get alarmed. Job 40 and verse 23 in a different translation, King James said it this way, behold, that he drinketh up the river and hasteth not. He doesn't get in a hurry. He trusteth that he can draw up Jordan into his mouth. There's a different view, isn't it? Imagine an animal of God's creation that would not have a problem in a flash flood. Now, I don't know if you've had much dealing with flash floods. Personal story. Back in Tennessee, I had to build a bridge over Smith Branch. Now, you can imagine, it's not going to be massive. In order to build my house in Tennessee, and so countless times we were flooded in and out, depending on how unprepared we were for the flash floods. The culverts, whose size I sorely underestimated, would clog up with limbs, and the trickle, and remember the Smith branch had a trickle year-round. It was constantly flowing. It never stopped. But the trickle would turn into a wave that was my height over the bridge, and I seriously wanted to try, I think I saw it on a Mountain Dew commercial, to try surfboarding that with a rope tied to a tree. You know, that's how massive it was and how fast it flowed. But note the pictures of the aftermath of the 2010 flood, the famous 2010 flood. That's sort of similar to what my bridge would look like as the water was making a wave. There used to be pavement here undisturbed for decades on this road and this parking lot that was kind of the same thing. I show you these pictures just because of the sheer power that we're talking about here. There was the little country store. Over on the left of the picture, there were regular and super unleaded gas pumps at the front porch. They were washed away, pulled up and washed away. Some Bible commentators, including Kaufman, have supposed that this last passage refers to a hippopotamus, an elephant, or a rhinoceros. I have to disagree completely with all those who have adopted this assumption. But the reality is, no one knows what this animal was that God was describing. For the sake of argument, let's say that it was a hippopotamus, or a rhinoceros, or an elephant. Dr. Dave Miller at Apologetics Press gave these statistics. Whereas a hippo weighs 3 to 4 tons, a rhinoceros 1 to 2 tons, an elephant 5 to 7 tons, that's some serious weight, isn't it? Pretty heavy. Are these animals immune to a flooding river? I don't know. I'm not sure. Maybe Mutual of Omaha's Wild Kingdom could have showed us an episode. I don't remember. Maybe they would be heavy enough to not be swept away. However, try telling that to the semi-truck driver who tried to cross the raging river. That's a pretty heavy device, isn't it? Before we move into the next thought, I know this, and I want you to know this. I am not a dinosaur aficionado. You knew that word was coming, right? Until reading some articles, I never even heard of some of these dinosaur names. Argentinosaurus weighed 80 to 100 tons. Doesn't it stand to reason this creature could have stepped in the raging Jordan River as if it were a water fountain or a splash pad? That's fun. Stomp it and just make it flop. And think about the bones of one of the smaller animals compared to a dinosaur. When one examines the skeletal structure of this is Dr. Miller speaking again, skeletal structure of any of the larger dinosaurs, one is immediately awed by the massive size of all its bones. An Apatosaurus femur alone was as tall as a 6-foot man. That's as tall as I am. With a Titanosaur femur, even longer. He went on to say, observe that the attributes selected by God to highlight the identity of Behemoth were specifically pinpointed and calculated to accentuate the unique features of this incredible creature, eliciting God's summary statement of Behemoth, chapter 40 and verse 19, he is the first of the ways of God. I didn't quite understand that statement until he explained it this way. I thought it was helpful. The underlying Hebrew word first translated first refers to size, mass, weight, bulk, force, or strength. God challenged Job with his inability to tame, to subdue, or control this massive creature, even as Leviathan is noted for its ferocity. Look again at the phrase, only he who made him can bring near his sword, verse 19. And so the implication is that humans would have great difficulty bringing down this creature. The reason God directed Job's attention to Behemoth is obvious. The gargantuan creature was of such stature and strength that only the Creator could control it. In order for God's argument to make sense or carry any weight with Job, Behemoth must be real. And I'm hoping that we all in here agree that it's a real animal, not of myth or folklore. Behemoth must be real and of such imposing, even ominous enormity, and of such immense powerful proportions that without hesitation Job would acknowledge his own helplessness. His measly condition before God. Neither a hippo nor an elephant would evoke such an admission. A dinosaur would. And I agree wholeheartedly. I think that's a great explanation. But what about Leviathan? Behemoth is massive. Behemoth is untamable. You're not going to capture him. But at least he only eats grass. That's a plus. That means he doesn't eat meat. Maybe humans could just stay out of the way of that massive tail and they might be okay. And remember, Job is having this beast described to him by the Almighty. He is describing it, Behemoth, after describing the common smaller animals like goats and lions, animals that Job recognized as real. Leviathan, understandably, was saved for the last because it's massive. It's ferocious. The whole 41st chapter is one overwhelming characteristic after another. In a moment, we'll highlight this description given by God, who made Behemoth, as he worded it to Job, he made Behemoth as he did Job. But first, have you heard or does any Bible give any footnotes about what men think this Leviathan is or was? I have a footnote in my New American Standard Version that says this is a crocodile. Okay, let's see what you think. See what you think about after you listen to God's words about it and with those rhetorical questions. And make certain you understand that when God was asking these questions, they are obviously followed by and with all the answers of no. And there's no way. You're not going to accomplish any of these questions. And if Job were bold enough to say another word, he would just say no, 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 over and over again. Notice that Leviathan can't be caught with a fish hook. Job 41 and verse 1, can you draw out Leviathan with a hook or snare his tongue with a line which you lower? He can't be roped through the nose or hooked through his jaw. He won't play nice like Tweety Bird. The New American Standard says it this way, he won't make supplications. He won't plead or pray to you. And I throw in this thought, he won't be asking you for mercy. You see, he's ferocious. He won't be your servant, verse 4. You won't catch him and show him off to the ladies, verse 5. This is God saying this. This is good stuff. Traitors won't be bargaining for him, verse 6. Yeah, I think I'll pass, they might say. Harpoons and fishing spears won't hurt him, verse 7. Verse 8, Job 41 and verse 8, lay your hand on him. Remember the battle, you will not do it again. Try to arouse Leviathan. No one is so fierce, verse 10. For a moment in the dialogue, by God, he stops describing Leviathan. He takes a breath, reiterates why he's telling Job this. And I have to say, this is a good point. Job 41, verses 10 through 12. No one is so fierce that he dares to arouse him. Who then is he that can stand before me? Who has given to me that I should repay him? Whatever is under the whole heaven is mine. I will not keep silence concerning his limbs or his mighty strength or his orderly frame. A little side note, some have have concluded this creature is a mythical creature. But how could God speak so clearly and detailed about an animal in context that he created if this was a myth or symbolic in nature? And we're not talking about what the Apostle John saw in a vision in Revelation with multiple heads and multiple horns and all of those things. He's describing a real animal just like you describe the elephants and the lions and all of that. In this, God describes many animals that he created, which we know are real, and ends with the greatest of all, Leviathan. He goes on. Who can strip off his armor, verse 13? Who can open his face? I like that. Who can open his face and check his teeth, so to speak? There is terror there, verse 14. The scales that he describes, the scales, they're tight. There's no air that will pass between them. They're joined one to another, verses 15 and 16. Would you describe fish scales as this tight? Now, when I was growing up, and Dad set me in front of a pond with a cane pole and a float and a hook, and he baited my hook for me at 5 years old, of course. And when I pulled out the brim and the bluegill, and we brought the stringer of fish home, he says, "You caught them, you clean them." And I remember not liking it very much, but the scales would move. They were flexible. They were individual. You could pull one off at a time if you wanted to. Can you imagine fish scales if they were like this? And let's stop right there. You knew I was going to say dinosaurs, but what about this word? What is your take on dragons? How do you view them? Myth or legend? Well, let's see, what did God say about Leviathan? Job 41, verses 18 through 21. His sneezes flash forth light, and his eyes are like the eyelids of the morning. Out of his mouth go burning torches. Sparks of fire leap forth. Out of his nostrils smoke goes forth, as from a boiling pot and burning rushes. Now, the only way I can describe that is a wildfire. That's how rapidly those rushes would burn up because they're so dry and tender, just burn up that quick. So you can imagine if he has fire coming out, that's what we're talking about. His breath kindles coals, and a flame goes forth from his mouth. Now, if you think this is symbolic or exaggeration, remember, God has been speaking plainly. I can't reiterate this enough. Since he began speaking to Job, his points about his eternal nature, his creative power, have been brought home with evidences of real facts. And the pattern has not changed with this beast, Leviathan. Verses 22 to 34, God goes on and on about Leviathan's overwhelming power. We won't read the whole thing, but notice some of the things that stick out to me. Verse 24, his heart is hard as a stone, even as hard as a lower millstone. In other words, no mercy. If I want to eat you, I'm going to. No mercy. Verse 25, when he raises himself up, the mighty fear. Well, does that sound like a towering crocodile to you? Towering, when he raises himself up. I just wonder if the crocodile hunter would have given us an opinion on Leviathan's real identity. You know, you remember the crocodile hunter, right? What can hurt him? A sword? No. A spear? No. A dart? No. A javelin? The answer is still no. He thinks of iron as weak as straw. You know, something that you can just break in your fingers. He thinks of bronze as rotten as wood. If you're going to find a weak spot on a dinosaur-sized animal, where would you think? You know, if you're looking for a way to take him down, you'd be thinking about his, and think about the phrase that might answer that question, the weak underbelly. You know, you hear that a lot. You hear that even in business world. Somebody or the business has a weak underbelly. Think about a turtle. The shell is truly an armor, but there are weak places underneath. Around the legs or whatever, there's going to be soft spots. It didn't make sense in verse 30 to me, except in the New King James Version. His undersides are like sharp potsherds. Now, maybe you don't know what that word means, but think of broken glass or broken pottery. So think about jagged edges, but that's his belly. He spreads pointed marks in the mire or the mud, as if Leviathan, in my view, I can see it now with the way this is written, as if Leviathan leaves a jagged trail through the mud as his belly slides along. Can you imagine a broken piece of pottery? I don't know how long, but you can imagine how big this must have been. And he's dragging that along, leaving a trail worse than Bigfoot ever thought of. If you have a clearer picture on this translation, or this verse, explain the verse to me. But what a summary God ends with. If you had any doubt up to now about this animal being unbelievably ferocious and massive and not a crocodile for crying out loud, notice verse 33 to 34. Nothing on earth is like him. One made without fear. He looks on everything that is high. He is king over all the sons of the pride. Do you have a mind or a thought about what that means? With that last verse, the word pride, according to the Strong's Concordance, is related to the lion's pride. So you think of the king of the jungle as the lion. Well, think again. God says that the king of the animal world is Leviathan. Nothing else was like him. Next week, we may try to show a few examples from history and folklore, but especially several Bible passages about dragons. But before we do, let's close with this observation. Dragons, according to 2005, the Animal Planet aired a program later released on DVD titled Dragons, A Fantasy Made Real. There's one creature remembered in the legends of almost every human culture. Now, I didn't know this. This is fascinating to me. A creative depictive or be depicted, or I mean a creature depicted with remarkable similarity by the Chinese, the Aztecs, even the Inuit, who live in a frozen land where no reptiles are found. Even they have stories of this animal, the dragon. Cultures from different continents, people who had no contact with one another, yet all of them have stories describing the same mythical animal. I just think that's fascinating. So you think about some of the stories and some of the people in history who said, I've seen them, I've hunted them, I've killed them. We'll see if we can get to the bottom of that. But so next time on Animals of the Bible, fire-breathing dragons, myth, fantasy, legend, or created beings. I hope that the lesson's helpful to you, encouraging to you, or whatever. But thank you for coming, and we'll call our class adjourned.